Well, my name is Dr. Vanessa Goodard, and I'm a recent graduate of National Lewis University, class of 2021, but I will be walking across that stage this June, actually Saturday. And I have my community psychology doctoral degree in, my focus was all about self-care, but I used a photo voice and kind of a photo ethnography synthesis kind of approach to better understand Black women and the barriers to engaging in active, monitored, and cyclical self-care. So that radical self-care that starts and that you monitor for a lifetime. What things, what obstacles get in the way of that monitoring and engaging in those kind of actions? So it's been about 3 years, and I started my organization, Reclaim Self-Care Chicago, out of my dissertation baby, and that's been going really awesome as well. So I'm excited to be a part of community psychology. It was a very natural transition into community psych for me, coming from education and being a Chicago public schools teacher for the last 15 years. I was always looking to solve problems as a community and not kind of be in those silos of our classrooms. So a lot of the work that I've done with self-care has trickled over into teacher self-care and preventing burnout and sharing those things that work for teachers as well. So radical self-care is that engagement in self-care actions, which is, let me just back up one more time and define what self-care is. Self-care is that monitoring of healthy habits with or without the supervision of a healthcare provider. So you're in partnership with someone to engage in self-care, as well as working as an individual level, working at a group level. It's accountability as an individual, the group level, the medical level. It's very much so an ecological approach, which is one of the reasons why I love marrying community psychology with self-care, because the models that we use, Rauffenbrenner model that we use, works really well with application to self-care. But radical is, what can I do right now in this moment to begin what self-care looks like for me? Is stopping everything that I'm doing, all obligations to all other people, and prioritizing yourself first in order to be able to engage in those helping obligations that, you know, we are bound to with caregiving and being moms and being a good uncle and all of the obligations we have to other people. Is stopping those things in their tracks and prioritizing yourself and the needs of self.
Yeah, because it's the question of who heals the healer in this case, because oftentimes people take on those roles, but there's not always a system of support to help them replenish themselves. Like, what are the sources of sustenance that give you life as someone who is helping other people, you know, heal and take care of themselves? So it is a good... Like, radical self-care is important because we also have to think about it in terms of how everyone needs to practice it, even those who are supposedly healthy and supposedly the experts in how to be mentally healthy.
So the thing about it is balance. And one of the concepts that's a part of my theoretical model is looking at role imbalance. And for the 175 Black women that identified marital status as a barrier to self-care, when I dove deeper into that, it was the roles of mommy, missus, and me that were imbalanced. And it's very challenging to maintain the role of me when you have missus and you have mommy roles to fulfill. So self-care is really about trying to find that balance between your spiritual, your mental, and your physical, which can be extremely challenging if you identify as a person of color. Can be extremely difficult if you identify as a woman. But if you intersect and have those identities, it's even more challenging. So especially when society is kind of structured to make all of the weight fall on one particular group. So in my experience, that has been the case where Black women feel very overwhelmed and bombarded with the expectation of being super and of being, you know, magical. And we really just want to be human. I personally dealt with these issues as, you know, the imbalance of mommy, me, and missus when I was previously married a few years ago. Somewhat recently divorced, but back in those days when I was married, I did have challenges with maintaining the balance of those roles. But when life hit and I started to have physical challenges that put me in the hospital and mental challenges that brought up depression and anxiety and PTSD and all of these things that my community really didn't know how to deal with or address or even talk about. It was truly the we don't talk about Bruno moment in my family. I had to kind of look for other resources. So, you know, the internet is wonderful. I was able to find a wonderful group online called Fertility for Colored Girls that supported me with basically acceptance in my journey of infertility and hysterectomy and just better understanding that I wasn't alone. And I think that that community piece is huge for people who look like me to understand that I'm not isolated in these emotions that I'm feeling. I'm not really solo with this, but I have to find that bravery and the audacity to come out of and be vulnerable. And being vulnerable is like sometimes can feel like a dirty word because a lot of times people can be hurt, you know, by being left vulnerable. When we think vulnerable, we think I'm open to be hurt. But to become vulnerable in a space that has been structured as safe, that has been built to be safe, like even a virtual space or a physical space that has been built to share and interact with your community, then it can become safe to be vulnerable. And that's when that healing and radical self-care can really take root and you can explore that.
I am Dr. Harita McDowell. I am a community psychologist and my research is specific to African-American female sexual communication that leveraged Pretty Incorporated, a nonprofit specific to cultivating healthy sexual relationships and positivity surrounding sexuality for girls of color from 11 to 21. I am an author of Black Women, Sex, and the Lies Our Mothers Told Us. Just made the list for top 21 books for Black women on Amazon. So that's me. All of my research I love and enjoy because I get to talk to Black women every day, all day in some capacity about sex. And I would say the highlight of my day today, just because, you know, I love to start with those. We got a museum dedicated to the three Black female, who I call the mothers of gynecologies, who were slaves and who were used to create the speculum that we use right now in gynecology. So I'm happy that all three of them are being honored because we wouldn't have any gynecological tool if they weren't experimented on. So I'm really, really happy that that was breaking news for me today. So that's one piece, but those type of things are what really leveraged my interest, understanding that Black women were birthing a nation, but they weren't enjoying sex. They had no idea about anything because it was just something that happened. Even the term rape is new. So when I spoke to, you know, the grandmothers of us and the great grandmothers, they're like, hey, everybody did that. What do you mean rape? What is that? So the very concept of sexual abuse is not even a Black one until maybe 45 years ago. So I wanted to know, well, what have we been doing other than having babies and raising them? Do we know any of the good stuff about sex? Do we know any of the positivity surrounding sex? And it was like, no, well, how do we start? We got to start all the way at the beginning. And that is where my qualitative research specific to storytelling came to place when I got a lot of different Black women to tell me their stories. And then as a researcher, I found the correlation and understood that, hey, we got a lot of barriers because there are a lot of things that we don't know because we've been busy surviving. So we haven't been able to thrive in sex. And now we are. So I'm happy to be the bearer of good news to Black women and explain all of the goodness about sex and sexuality and sexual health. That leveraged itself to start a nonprofit. And I would say my dream or my to-do list for the nonprofit next is to have a three-day all-Black girl retreat so they kind of get to understand what barriers they can break in their adolescent years so they have better sexual experiences than we did. In a nutshell.
I like how you mentioned vulnerability because that's something that often is an issue when talking about something like self-care, and particularly when we are talking about mental health, is the vulnerability to say that I need help and I need some help with something that's not necessarily provable or tangible is something that can easily be like explained by just saying, oh, it's just like this. You just add it together. It's not simple mathematics for folks. So it's the additional vulnerability of having to open yourself up to someone possibly saying that your view of reality isn't valid or that your view of reality is wrong because it's not something that is necessarily tangible in the material world as we typically think about it. So we talk about it's things of you talk about being more attentive to spirituality and being connected to different support networks. I think that always ties together with why it's hard for people to talk about mental illness and mental health because it's their own struggles with what is reality, and then they're having to lay that out to another person to possibly say like, oh, what's going on? Because that's typically how we do, how a lot of people respond to anything that's mental health related. Like there's still a bit of a stigma even now, given we know a lot more, but there's still a little bit of like stigma in terms of lack of understanding on what to do in the scenarios.
You know, we don't want to be perceived as weak. That is a bad word as well. Weakness, because again, weakness can get you killed. Weakness can leave you very, very vulnerable where you could be hurt, not only physically, but emotionally when you lose that acceptance from the inner group. I think when you, one thing that's really cool about being specific about cultural community work and working specifically with Black women and people who look like me is that I can relate and relate to the inner group as well as see some things from the outside as a researcher. That's the beauty of being an educator, is that I've learned how to evaluate situations, you know, within my classroom, and I'm taking those same strategies and applying them in qualitative research. And it's really important for us to maintain that acceptance within our in-group, within our culture, because it's so much rejection that happens outside of the culture. So if I say that, you know, I'm struggling with my mental health, first of all, that's not necessarily the language you're going to hear. You might hear I have the blues or I'm feeling really down. But a lot of times we don't know how to take those cues and do anything or give advice, healing advice. We kind of blow it off a lot of times because, again, the expectation is strength. So we know that it's a lot of adversity that Black folks deal with. So this is just one more thing, right? You can handle this. You've handled so many other things. So you should be able to handle this. And we tend to gauge the Black experience based on what we've seen, you know, our ancestors and forefathers do, fighting racism and fighting injustices, you know, marching for different inequalities. But day to day, being Black is hard. It's hard. And we tend to, you know, get our drink. We tend to, you know, get our smoke, whatever we're going to do to kind of numb and desensitize from all of the things that are all the trauma that's happening around us, because it's outside of church. I really don't see a whole lot of spaces where this is normalized. And even within church, you know, you're taught to kind of pray things away and give it away to God. And it's just like, well, I can be a spiritual person and have a therapist. I can be a spiritual person and admit that I'm suffering from bipolar disorder. But we have to normalize these things. Like you said, Dominique, it's about just normalizing it and just desensitizing the stigma around what's going on with our mental health. I think it's important to create space so that Black women, Black men, could be Black kids, Black families can be vulnerable, because that vulnerability is not a tool that is heavily used in our households. And I think it's up to the experts to create that structure so that they could take that structure home and share it with the community and share it with the neighborhoods and families. So a lot of what Dr. McDowell's work and my work constitutes is creating that safe space for us to become family for the night or for the day, and have an open conversation that's safe, that that welcomes vulnerability, so that we can get some open, honest answers from one another and actually put them in our toolkit.
So on one hand, on one side, you have, well, really both parts of it are truth telling, but truth telling in different, well, really in the same vein of like, what do we need,
right,
from one another?
And for me, in my research, it was, what does it look like? Because photo voice is a major component of my research. I'm not sure if you guys are aware, but it's the 30th anniversary of Burris and Wang's methodology. There will be a conference later on this year that I plan to present for, or at least submit for. And it's a fascinating way to collect information. A lot of times we come into communities and we just start asking questions. We don't, as Rita might say, get the foreplay going. You know, we don't tend to, you know, warm our participants up with inquiring about their lives, checking in with them for the day, seeing if we can make them laugh and become comfortable so that you can make space for vulnerability. So photo voice, I use a lot of methods to get my participants to open up, things that I learned from the classroom, icebreakers and things like that. But photo voice was pivotal in actually seeing what things were in the way of Black women's self-care as it related to those participants. They actually were able to show me what that looked like, and it was really cool. Because a lot of times it's seen as inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And I hear you, Rita. I'm going to let you talk. I'm going to let you finish, like Kanye say. It's really inaccessible. One thing I want to just say quickly is that I know I'm an 80s baby. And for me, self-care looked like my granddaddy going to Bally's. And that was a huge luxury back then, because it wasn't something that was as accessible for a lot of my friends, their parents. So I would like for self-care to be free. I would like people to know that self-care is free. You don't need a membership to anything to access it. It starts with you. It starts when you open your eyes and you go into the mirror and you say the first affirmation to yourself. So how do we make that notion more broadly known, that, you know, you don't have to get a membership or get a YouTube subscription to this influencer to make self-care happen for you?
Right. I think that to piggyback, I love that word, off of vulnerability and understanding, like Black researchers deciding to create a methodology. Even though we have literature that we can read, we still have to reformat. And I think that the idea, even in my research, that, hey, I'm aware that I'm asking Black women to talk about something extremely vulnerable and extremely open and sometimes extremely shameful. And I had to think of a way to not be a normal researcher and understand that there are some huge trust challenges with Black women in research, and we had to redirect and reroute. So while I understood, you know, what my methods class was giving me, I understood that I'm going to have to do something a bit different. We're going to have to just let Black women talk. And as researchers, we pull out what we want, not probe. We have to recalculate what spaces look like. They don't need to come down to your big white institution and sit in a classroom and you know, give them a worksheet and they check boxes off and you're asking them about their whole real life trauma. So I got a lot of Chicago local bars, restaurants, beauty salons, and we sat and we talked. Did I have a note taker? Yes. Did we make sure the IRB was signed, forms were signed, and all of the protocol was followed? Absolutely. But we had to understand the vulnerability, understand the history based on lack of trust, and understand that we have to reroute. And that rerouting, I I'm proud of because it's how I got a lot of the information that I got in a very different way. So just like Photo Voice, you got to find a different way to get the information out because you can't just say, well, Black women don't participate in research. That's why we don't fill in the blank. No, you have to find out a different way to research because we understand the history of the country and why we don't answer regular questions. So now you want me to talk about sex and self-care? Get out of here. What are you going to do with this information? How are you going to exploit us with this information? Where are you? Why are you taking the demographic? Are you going to say everybody in my neighborhood must be promiscuous because, you know, we're going over here to get whatever? It's always a thing. And I think Black researchers specifically can take that thing out and provide an energy that opens up for vulnerability, it opens up for conversation, and then we can get the details that we need to kind of leverage policy and research and publications and train new researchers to do the same.
Rita, yes, all of that. I do research for the fast tail girls, the ones that everybody has wrote off and think that they know their story, but really, truly have no idea what keeps a person doing the things that they do. Rita, you were amazing during your research period when you was in the incubator. You got to go in person.
Yeah,
I had to come up with this stuff virtually. That was the challenge for me in getting Black women to open up and be honest with me about what was really in the way. I went on Etsy actually and connected with some different vendors to find virtual parties, virtual questions, and different games that we can play that were specific to Black culture, like nothing generic, just specific to Black women in our culture. I did invite my participants to bring a drink, alcoholic or non. I didn't ask what was in anybody's cup, but we were all virtual and I wanted them to feel comfortable. So that invitation was open. We had music before I asked any question. And I also made sure that they knew that I had something for them for their time because we're always asking Black women to work for free and to give us things for free. No, I value your time. And I wanted them to have at least a gift card to show that I appreciated their time and their efforts to help me understand and answer my research questions. So I just don't believe, like Rita said, we have picked and prodded at Black folks for centuries to get key pivotal information from the Tuskegee experiment to Henrietta Lacks, you name it. And so now we're going to ask for permission, but we're also going to make sure that we are actually creating that family environment so that they know that I'm not going to leave with this information and not ever return to this community. I'm actually hoping that this information will benefit this community.
There's actually a cultural thread that is undeniable. I was on a project with Stanford University specific to Black women and breast cancer and really just understanding the challenge with elder Black women getting nude for a medical appointment. And I started one of my conversations with Miss Juanita. And we went through, I had my list of questions and we just had a conversation. And at the end, one of the other researchers who was observant said, well, how did you know to call her Miss Juanita? And of all of the questions that I was, you know, prepared as a doctor to answer, I'm going to give you all of these numbers and all this stuff. I said, what? How did I know to call her Miss Juanita? She's an elder. And they asked him, well, how are you so comfortable with Dr. McDowell? Well, she acts just like my niece. She speaks to me like my grandbaby does. I can't teach that. I can't, you know, give a lecture on that specific energy that gives us a cultural thread. My research being on mother-daughter communication, specifically, I had to gain an understanding of who these women were as daughters. So they had to pick in the space that we were in a woman that was closest to their mother. I used pictures of Madea, Cookie from Empire, Claire Huxtable, Aunt Viv. I pulled pictures of mothers from the culture, and I understood that the description of that mother, if you pick Madea, I can go and say, okay, your grandmother raised you very Southern, very direct, very religious, but also violent. I didn't have to explain that. When they stood by Madea, my note taker knew what type of mother. If they said cookie, okay, your mother was in the streets. Your mother hustled. Your mother was in prison. Your mother is a bit more feared in some spaces. So you maybe had an aggressive approach to sex and sexuality. Claire Huxtable, don't need to give an explanation for her or Anvia. And those things leverage the rest of the conversation because they weren't in there trying to understand what I meant or who that person, who's this picture of? I've never watched that show or I don't know that artist. It culturally, we were family, so it was really easy for me to jump to a really challenging question that was easy to answer that might not have been if I wasn't a Black woman.
It's like the information that it would take a cultural anthropologist years to have it, you already got by just being in it.
That's it. So when they ask, well, what is your suggestion? Train more Black researchers. Give scholarships for Black women to be researchers and in every single field and train them how to do it and hire them.
I also have an addition to that. my addition would be to really focus on how can we infuse autoethnography into our research approaches? Because if I identify with this culture, and that was my biggest pushback during dissertation, was like, listen, I understand that I'm the researcher, but I'm letting you know that I have training as an educator, and I can utilize and flex that training as an educator to be both participant and observer and not let those two roles interact or affect the other. I can maintain those dual roles and still collect the information that I need to collect. It's really important because me being and sharing that identity as a strong Black woman and knowing what comes with that also helped to build that sense of community and that sense of belonging and trust that some researchers can't quite get to. And it's a question that I'm looking to answer is, how are we, and I wrote it on my wall, how are we discussing wellness as a culture sharing collective? So when you think of, when you center your work in that, you start to get creative with how you want Black women to engage or Black folks or marginalized folks to engage with these questions, because you're really thinking about the intersections between your culture that you share. And how do you highlight that so that, especially when it comes to food, when it comes to fashion, pop culture,
music,
all of these things are hubs and intersections for who we are as a people, as a humanity. So you have to get creative and you use those sources so that, you know, we can see that we're a lot less different than, a lot more alike.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And you made me think about something you actually stated earlier about, so when people say that they're going through something, like they'll say like, oh, I have the blues. And I thought back about this book I read about the blues, about that talks about the blues epistemology that comes out of the Mississippi Delta and how this epistemology or way of looking at the world and navigating the world and knowing the world is born out of Black like perseverance through the post-Reconstruction era of the South and having to deal with the oppression that we were undergoing, especially like in the in Mississippi, like in the Delta. So it's the music that is this like this manifestation of this way of knowing of navigating the world that is infused in all of its other, you know, offspring. So, you know, you hear this in jazz, you hear this in hip hop, you hear this in R&B. Gospel, like yes. You hear it all, and like in blues, and like blues is like the main foundation of all of those, because
right,
you know, blues also being related to the blues, meaning the troops that had to leave after Reconstruction was done, because the blues leaving was those troops leaving who were protecting Black people from you know, racial fascism that was happening down here. Well, not here, but like I'm from Mississippi. That's why I kind of will say that. But in Mississippi, so it's interesting how like these different art forms and different cultural products all come from essentially the a similar set of like epistemologies and philosophies on and ways of viewing the world. So
right.
They are all a different manifestations of this shared experience that we've had, and in different ways, like the shared traumas that we've had too. And you see it reflected like yeah. in our music and in our art forms and in our different cultural products as well. So
it's very interesting because that's a trope of, and I say trope positively, of Black researchers. I'm not sure of a Black researcher that does not incorporate music. At the beginning, at whether they're hosting or in the middle, during breaks. And it's interesting that even in my classes, we open up with music because it can set a tone. And I wasn't taught that either. You know, when you quote, you know, anything that you just quoted regarding the Mississippi Delta and understanding the trials, the triumphs, the pain, the happy times, it's all musical and it's all culture, and it's something that you would never think to instruct somebody to do. A lot of stuff is just innate. Or like Dr. Goodall said, the food, the space. It's just certain things that we know to check for according to where you're from, how old we think you are. If you are considered an elder or somebody that's younger than us, we're raised to be a way that is truly, it could be transcribed, but the minute you transcribe it, we're doing something cooler or something else.
Yeah.
We're oral storytellers, though. Our people are oral storytellers. Like, we learned to put food in our hair and travel, you know, leave the South because someone told us to. Our grandmothers and four grandmothers told us to. But, you know, our people, even though, Dominique, you're from Mississippi, we born and raised in Chicago, but I bet you that we have some shared cultural things because our families migrated from the South and came to Chicago to escape what you very well know to be fascist Southern America. So,
I guess literally in my hometown. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but with a gender or identifying as a woman, to add to what you said, Dr. Goodall, regarding humanity. Everything that I'm doing with my research is specific to my culture, but can be taught to someone to teach it specific to their culture. Because when I have students that are Latinx and I have students who are even Russian who explain things to me, I've had students from Canada, and when I have some of my students say, you know, Dr. Mack, I never had to tell my love story, which is sometimes the opening to my human sexuality class. It's like, well, what about the two people that brought you here? When I hear those stories, a lot of the things that happen with those women are very, very, very similar to any disenfranchised culture, because in a lot of spaces, women are the disenfranchised gender. So if you take out some of the things that make me a Black woman specifically and made me do certain things specifically because I research Black women, they can pull that part of all my research out and insert their culture in. So this is one of those things with just women and sex and sexuality and identity. This is a humanity thing. You know, when we think about Roe, that's not a Black woman thing. You're taking it away from all of us. You're telling everybody that is scientifically born and forced to identify as female that they may be born into a world where those rights are taken away. You know, so with our work, I would say that if I was asked what's my hope and dream for, you know, me 50, 60 plus, is that I see my work translated in every single language with every single culture, making sure that they have a hands-on approach to the sexual identities of their daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters.
But I think that's the importance of centering the culture, because as community psychologists, when we do our strength analysis and see what are the things that community has that's working, the first things that you'll see is traits and characteristics of culture. And any of us who evaluate or build programs and create programs, we do that initial analysis in the beginning to better understand who you're working with. Sometimes I think in the past, we may have approached research just strictly from a quantitative point of view. We have 500 participants we need to serve, and we have to get this impact done, and we're going to give a pre and a post to see if it worked. And sometimes it's a little deeper than that. So sometimes you got some barriers that make a person not want to open up. And like Rita said, you can't teach that. You have to it's a je ne sais quoi, where you just kind of know. You have to just be in the space, be familiar with the culture. I don't know that I would be okay with just going to a culture I don't know anything about and trying to implement my strategies into that culture when I don't know that culture, and that culture don't know me. So how can I expect them to respond the way that I envisioned, the way that I planned, if I haven't taken the time to get to know that culture? And not just a representative. I mean, the people who will be participating. That's one of the reasons why participatory action research is just the way that I like to go, because I want to build these systems and these programs and initiatives, policies with you, not just for you. I want you to build them with me because you're the one who's going to benefit from
it. Yeah, I like the idea of co-creating with the community, because it's like you said, oftentimes researchers will come in having the idea of creating something for the community rather than discussing things with people. And that's part of the mistrust too, because someone comes in who's not part of your community claiming to know what's best for you without really talking to you about it or actually consulting with you about your experiences. And it's just saying like, oh, well, I know more because I have X degree, even though I know actually nothing about this environment.
Then that's challenging, because it's from block to block. Like, I'm from the south side of Chicago. What I know is that I'm not from Inglewood specifically. I understand the community Inglewood. I understand what some of the nonprofit leaders are trying to do in that neighborhood. So if I decided that I was going to pop up in Inglewood, I would go through some of the major stakeholders that already have built community trust out of respect. And it's just like me going to someone's home for a holiday. I'm not going directly to their refrigerator. I'm not even going to eat first. And that's something that I was trained to do, because that comes off as disrespectful. So it's the same thing in researching a space. I'm not from this community, this home, this space, but I'm going to come in because I'm a Michelin star chef and tell your grandmother about cranberry sauce. I'm sorry, sir. You have to go. You know, and that's the exact same thing.
You don't know about my cranberry sauce. You know,
and it's the same thing as you saying, because you're Dr. So-and-so and researcher who and what, from name that, you know, league of university, you can't come in here and ask me about none of that. You're not from here. And it comes off as angry, or maybe you come off as putting, but it's off-putting. Say that three times. But it's really because culturally, you don't know what's disrespectful from home to home, because you didn't ask them what was disrespectful. So if I'm not asking participants to work with me, or if I'm stepping in a space arrogantly as if I know all of these stories because I read some books and wrote some papers, no, that type of pretense will never get you any data to ever use to advocate any type of change, because you're a doctor and a researcher. To say you're a doctor or a researcher, you're not really for the community or the work of the research you want to share.
And it's like mistrust that comes from knowing that the MDs and the PhDs were oftentimes the very ones who created the problems anyway. Like, you know, basically torturing women to create the field of gynecology, the syphilis, the syphilis study. I use quotation marks since we won't be able to see it, but the study that was basically doctors and PhDs lying to people, telling them that they had quote unquote bad blood. So giving them misinformation, disinformation, or whatever you like to call it, by giving them information about their medical status that was untrue and that would have consequences for their sexual partners. So it's also just like the danger that straight up comes from them coming in assuming that they know everything when they don't actually have your best intentions with your best interests at heart oftentimes.
But also, when you think about not just the things of the past, but even today, and how I don't know how old Serena's daughter is now, but I know that when she was pregnant with her, that she almost lost her life because she was not believed about her pain tolerance. And I know that there's research that shows that white healthcare providers tend to think that Black patients can tolerate more pain than white patients or patients who are not Black. And I think that that's extremely alarming because as a person who suffered from reproductive issues and reproductive challenges within a hospital and was ignored and sent home just to find out that I had a pulmonary embolism, I know that this is something that we experience on the day to day and that Black women are losing their lives over. So, you know, I think that it's just important to, like Dr. Mack said, and do work that expands upon having researchers who look like the people that they will be serving. That goes for any field. If you are serving patients that don't look like you, you need to support having more patients, more healthcare providers and other people, practitioners, who do look like those patients, because it's a lot more difficult to build trust among people who need support. And I really don't like that word support or help. I like to take out those words and put in the action that you need. So don't say help. I would like to talk to someone about my anxiety. You know, don't say I need support. Say I need to get out of this situation with this domestic partnership. I like to try to take those words out because they tend to make us unable to talk about our issues. Say that again.
Needy. None of us specifically want to go into a place where we know we have a need and then you repeat it again and say we're in need because now we're needy.
Right. And it's demoralizing. It's dehumanizing to have to keep repeating that. And it's shameful. So let's try to maintain and create empowerment for the humanity of our participants and let them lead the way and tell us, well, what's working. And then let's see what is discovered that's not working out of finding the strengths first. That's another issue that I have, is that we always go in, what's the needs assessment? And I can't stand that word. I know that's something common within psychology that we use. We're going to do a needs assessment. Well, maybe we should start with the strengths analysis, because I think that if we start with the strengths analysis, it's a lot more empowering to go from what, you know, what things we can do and build off of that versus trying to build from below the ground and try to build from things that, you know, we know are going wrong in the community. We're fully aware of the needs that we have. But have you talked about the things that are working within the community that you're trying to serve?
And most of the needs haven't changed in 400 years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always debatable, for sure. But I'm just thinking that when we choose our words as researchers, it's a privilege. And I think when you create tools, whether written or otherwise, you really have to have a moment to research that demographic. And it's not as extensive as we may think it is, but even something as simple as me knowing to say, Miss Juanita, my word choices were accurate enough to make her comfortable in that space, as opposed to approaching her as if we were peers. And the same thing goes for saying things like help, need, wrong. Like it's almost like a simple English literature activity. Well, how do we use the positive word in place of?
You know what, though? I think that it's really important that we highlight our approach is really rooted in the intentionality of maintaining the utmost respect and honor for our participants. And I don't know that every researcher leaves with that intentionality. When you met Miss Juanita, your immediate intention was to show deference, was to show that you honor her as someone who has survived and you want to show how to thrive, or you want to explore what makes her thrive. So I think that your intentionality with approaching the research with deference and with respect, I think that goes a long way. And sometimes we don't do that. We have a job to do as evaluators. We have a job to do as, contracted. We got this RFP that we just got and we're rolling with things, but we don't want to steamroll while we're rolling with things. You have to take a step back. I have, Dr. Mack knows, and you guys may know Brad Olson too. One thing about Brad Olson that I learned from him, I remember that when he was working on one of his projects, he took over a year just getting to know the participants that he was going to be engaging in research with, breaking bread with them, eating meals, talking, laughing, talking about pop culture, because he knew that as a not being an insider of that community, he knew that he needed to build that sense of trust in the community. And I think that we can take a page from that and making sure that, especially if we identify with the culture, that we're taking very intentional approaches to making sure that they know that we're not just here to collect information. We're fully invested in making sure that you're able to benefit from the information that we're collecting.
And my final thought, only because I see our clock is ticking, you have to have you can be an evaluator, but the greatest thing about being a community psychologist and being trained by people like Brad or Judah or Suzette or name, you know, that leader in the field is you have to develop a love for that community. Because what it does is remove a bit of your bias, lack of understanding, ignorance to their story. And then you can go and do the work that you know how to do as a trained researcher. If you're deciding to say, I'm going to research something that has never been researched before, it has to be a labor of love. And usually what you love the most is something that's already close to you. So as much as I may have an affinity for men, I don't think I would love researching them as much as I love researching women. You know, as much as I have an affinity for food, don't really want to make food my work. You know, I don't have a love for it enough to really understand the ingredient like some of my favorite chefs do. So that's the je ne sais quoi that Dr. Goodhart mentioned, or the energy behind it. When I arrive, there's a feeling that I'm going to start talking about Black women and sex, and there's a feeling to it and an energy that connects to it that gets other women to start to talk. The same thing happens to Dr. Goodhart with self-care. I don't think I would get the same feedback, you know, if it was on classic cars. Name me.
You most certainly wouldn't.
No.